back-to-school savings are officially in session at Tanger Outlets. Shop the latest school styles with an extra 25% off during Tanger Style, our biggest sale of the season, now through August 25th. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. I have been chomping at the bit to post today's episode. Today, I am talking about ghosts and history with my guest, who is a paranormal professional, abundantly involved in many different avenues of it. He has a unique set of skills and is often called upon to employ those skills on well-known television programs about ghosts and hauntings and Sasquatch? We will get into all that he does and is involved with in just a few minutes. My new show, Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen, streamed our second episode on March 2nd. Thank you to everyone who tuned in, my fellow co-hosts and myself. Had a rad time telling our stories and relaying your stories and accepting live calls. We also welcome Joey from the Black Cat Report onto the regular panel. So the 3B family is now complete. Currently, we stream Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen via the Paranorm Girl YouTube channel and via the Black Cat Report YouTube channel. We will be adding a third streaming option here shortly, thanks to a little help from our friends. I just got the good news via our private chat that we have indeed reached the 1,000 necessary to go live on TikTok. It has been something that Damien, who is on the show and has been working very, very hard, he runs the page. He has just been diligent about it, and he just killed it. Absolutely killed it, dude. So thank you guys so much for the follows. And if you want to check out the next 3B live-streamed episode over there on April 6th, 4:30 p.m. Pacific, you can now do so. If you haven't yet followed the page, please hit that friend button next time that you are over there. Me and the boys really appreciate the love. All right, let's do a brief word from the show's sponsor and then bring on our guest. Top of the morning to ya! That was a little bit more Scottish. That's all right. This episode is brought to you by the St. Patrick's Day Shamrock Shavers Manscaped. This year, don't just chase rainbows. Make your own pot of gold and have the man in your life groom his little leprechaun with the leaders in below-the-kilt care. Say goodbye to his clover forest with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0 and let his confidence shine bright. Embrace the luck of the Irish and have him join the 10 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. Head over to manscaped.com and use code PNG for 20% off plus free shipping. This St. Patrick's Day, Lee and I will be carousing around the streets and venues of Las Vegas. Woo! I'ma eat some pasties, rock out to some flogging Molly, and Lee, my dear, sweet, innocent Lee, is going to be rocking a kilt. I am not joking. I have made him well aware of the dangers wind poses to the skirtly inclined, but alas, he is a manscaped and fearless lad. He's feeling lucky, I suppose, with his lucky charm for St. Patrick's Day, the Lawnmower 5.0 Ultra, the interchangeable next-gen skin-safe blade heads, easily provide the style option of choice under that there kilt. And its dual LED spotlight provides the option to change his mind while wearing the dang kilt. I can appreciate the convenience of a kilt. I can. But I do love the convenience of the Lawnmower 5.0. Ladies, he is your Willy to your Millie. You know it. So share a little luck with the guy and get 20% off and free shipping with the code PNG at manscaped.com. That is 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com with code PNG. This St. Patrick's Day, make sure his hairy little leprechaun is luckier than ever with Manscaped. My guest is a paranormal and military historian who has appeared on Coast to Coast AM, the History Channel's Haunted History, Ghost Adventures, Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, and has appeared 8 times as a guest expert on the Travel Channel's The Dead Files. His background includes 32 years in the U.S. Army and Reserves. He has a bachelor's in anthropology, a master's in archaeology. He is also an author of numerous books covering the haunts, local legends, cryptids, and sacred places of the Pacific Northwest. Please enjoy my conversation with Jefferson Davis.
It is a pleasure being here, Kristen. For audience members who don't get to see the behind-the-scenes kibitzing beforehand, I really enjoyed our chat. It's almost too bad we had to turn on the cameras. I was really enjoying talking to you.
Yeah, same. And for my listeners, they are all very aware because I did a whole episode, a debrief on my Squatch Fest journey. But we met at Squatch Fest. You had a table there, vendor table there, and you were selling your books, one of which I picked up. This is Ghosts, Critters, and Sacred Places of Washington and Oregon 3. So it's a series. Mm-hmm. And if this one is any indication, the first two are brilliant and excellent as well. This was so much fun to read. There was something specific about this that I really appreciated, mm-hmm. because I don't know if you can see in the dark here. I have a lot of books. I got a couple thousand books here, and I read a lot of them. I read a lot of ones that have haunted tales and legends and stuff, and not so many of them precede them with the history of the location, the history of the people. And I just think that is so incredibly important to the actual story of the haunting and what's actually taking place there. So I really love that about your book. We are going to get into that. But to start us out, because you are new to the show, new to my audience, would you mind introducing yourself? Give us the background. Who is Jefferson Davis?
Don't ask who I am, because that depends on which day, how did I wake up. I was born in the Pacific Northwest, Vancouver, Washington, actually. I come from kind of typical middle American blue collar background. One of my ancestors was a lumberjack. Another one had spent some time in the Army. My dad, full-time Army. And so I grew up with this very background, and I'm always curious, like you. I have a personal library of, I don't even know, a couple thousand books as well. And I kind of, not typical of my family, having all these books. And so I'm the first person in my family for quite a while who went to college. And in my life just took me different directions. I was always interested in archaeology. If anyone ever saw the original Mummy movie with Boris Karloff, the background of this and the backdrop is that the mummy revives in the midst of an archaeological expedition. And that's always in the background. And that got me interested in that. And following parallel military and archaeology careers, when I was on Army Reserve duty, I had the time, I worked as an archaeologist in the Cascade Mountains of Washington and Oregon. So this ties in with cryptids and Bigfoot and Native American and for the Northwest early settlement period. And all this stuff just kind of tied together. When I was working the Army, not too much for the ghosts, but when I was doing the archaeology, a little bit more on the ghosts, and it kind of went back and forth. And at a certain point, I said, you know what? I think I can write and publish my own books. And so I started with a little, was it 70 page booklet, took it to the local Kinko's, and they, you know, they, it was double sided. They printed out a bunch of copies, and then I stapled it in the middle and folded it over, which is how a lot of people start. You don't start a podcast with $1 million equipment in a studio. You usually start with your cell phone, and you work up from that. And so I've been quite fortunate publishing my own books and writing books and doing research for other people.
Well, I had a question. Actually, you said something there, and I have been wondering what work were you actually doing in the Cascades? I mean, I know it was archaeology, but what were you studying or looking at?
Well, yeah, it's this was when I first started working, because I'm old. This was in the very late 1980s and early 1990s, and it was in that time period that the Forest Service and the federal government said, let's really cut the trees. Let's cut down the trees for economic stimulus. And before you can cut down the trees, somebody needs to go out there as specialists. You need a hydrologist looking at water. You need an ichthyologist, a fish person. You need wildlife people. You need botanists, and you need archaeologists to go out and make sure your timber sale is not going to cut through the middle of an Indian village. And so I did pre-field research in the wintertime when we were frozen, you know, iced out, was in the office looking at old maps, reading books, looking at the geology and talking to the other specialists, and then out doing field survey, looking at the ground. And that also included going out and doing various archaeological excavations. And so that was all for about a four or five year period, I did that. Mount St. Helens, I was at the Wind River District in Skamania County, which is America's only Bigfoot free zone. You're not allowed to hunt Bigfoot there. And also the Umatilla National Forest and the Mount Hood National Forest. And in the midst of that, I moved to England for a year, and I received a master's in archaeology and prehistory from the University of Sheffield. Yay!
Wow, you have the coolest background. You know that? That is so cool. Well, I just like how you come from, you know, a scientifically, logically based, very serious with the military too, background. And this is your passion, like paranormal and discovering the histories and the cryptids, you know, histories. Like, it's just so cool to me. That is awesome. When I grow up.
I'm never growing up, but no, I had some very, very understanding bosses. Some of them thought, well, it's just a little bit of strangeness, but we'll let him stay in the Army. As a matter of fact, during a couple of my deployments, I worked as a military historian. I went out to various fire bases in Afghanistan, and I interviewed soldiers and civilians before and after various actions, and also getting ready to go home. And I did all this with the top secret clearance. And so my bosses said, yeah, he's a little bit strange, but this does not endanger. The federal government said a belief in the possibility of ghosts does not make someone crazy or a security risk. So if I've thrown that out there before, you ask me words of wisdom, it's okay. It's okay if you believe in the paranormal or the possibility, and open-minded people, even if they don't agree with you, will actually support you. As long as you don't get too strange.
Yeah. A friend of mine likes to say, you know, have an open mind, but not so open your brain falls out. He keeps telling me that over and over. I'm like, you know, that's true. That's true.
I occasionally have brain cramps. Yeah.
Oh, no. Same. Well, all right. So to really just kind of like throw us in here, I definitely want to get into the books. I'll ask you to recommend one too. But this is the one I picked up, Ghost Critters and Sacred Places of Washington and Oregon 3. Listeners, I highly recommend it. As I was going through it, I was the first question that occurred to me was like, how do you go about getting these stories, like finding the leads for these legends? There's so many in there. So I was just curious about that.
Well, I started out old school. This is in the 1990s. I started out, well, And people can do this now. If you live in a town that still has a paper newspaper or some kind of a newspaper, even online, many newspapers, the weekend before Halloween in their larger Sunday supplement, will have ghost stories from the county.
Oh.
So you can do online newspaper searches. If it's your own town, look for these signal events, which is, you know, those kind of holidays. So I actually did road trips where I would drive across Washington or Oregon, and I'd stop. I would email in advance reference librarians. Some of them did edge their way away from me. but others had the same curiosity. Even if they didn't believe in ghosts, the odd history should still be preserved. And so I would come. In some cases, they like welcome me. The Tacoma City Library has a Northwest room. And over the years, various librarians have purposely looked for and curated all these stories from that part, the Puget Sound. And so I would do these cross-country trips. I'd try and arrange to meet somebody. In some cases, let's face it, paranormal tourism. If you happen to have a haunted hotel somewhere in Eastern Oregon, sometimes guests are few and far between, particularly off-peak. And so some places promote their haunted history sometimes too much. Oftentimes it is, in researching Ghosts and Critters 3, in some cases the particular manager has a lot of leeway themselves. And I have been contacted by email or phone by people who say, hey, you want to come and investigate and do a story on us? And mm-hmm. and so there's the internet, there's paper, there's document back files, and referrals from live people. This is the nice thing. Once you write a couple books and people become fans, they contact you with their stories. So that makes beginning of the research easy. And yeah. Yes, as you pointed out, I tend to give the history first. This is my historic background, but also what does make a ghost story interesting is not the effect of the haunting. It is not you open a door and this thing comes out and ectoplasms you. is who is the ghost? Why is the ghost even there in the closet? What's the historic background? And I think most people are that way. So if people don't like history, it's because they have had bad history teachers. Because history is interesting, is cool. Ghost stories, in a very real way for a lot of us, tie us to the past, because you can go to a haunted house and know this is Reverend John Smith's house and he's a ghost haunting it. Here's why. It is almost tactile. And for those people who've been touched by ghosts, it's very tactile.
Yeah. Well, you said there that, yeah, people will start to reach out to you. And that's actually what happened for one of the cases that you are like, I'm not sure what to call it. It's a case. It was a walkthrough. Somebody reached out to you. Would you please come and take a look at this building? And it was the Civic Apartments in Portland. And yes. I was hoping, just to give my listeners a taste of what's in the book, would you mind going through that information? What happened there was really, really interesting.
Yes. This was a walkthrough for people who are watching, listening to this podcast. With a little bit of experience, you know that there are different levels and degrees of paranormal investigating. There's a referral. Somebody contacts a team or an individual and says, we've got this happening. Can you come? And so you make an initial survey. That's my word, is you make an initial survey and visit, and then you decide whether or not it's worth coming back. And then you may make 2, 3, or 4 visits with various paranormal gear, and or some kind of a research design. And then you collate all the data, and then you publish a report. And so in this case, the Civic Apartments don't exist anymore. So for those people who are thinking about, wow, this is really kind of a cool haunt, I'm going to go get an apartment there. You can't, because it was very old apartments and they demolished them for something a little more upscale. Whether or not this stuff is still happening in the new building, I don't know, because it was replaced by another apartment complex. Maybe if anyone here is from Portland and they were ever in the buildings. It's near the stadium that replaced Civic. That'd be interesting to know. So the manager contacted me and said, hey, can you come and investigate? We need to get this done before the complex gets emptied out. So some of the units were empty already, and some of them still had tenants looking for new lodgings. And if anybody here has looked at the literature, I'm not sure if you have, Kristen. Have you ever heard of Hans Holzer?
I've heard of them, yeah.
Oh, it's a he. Hans Holzer was writing paranormal investigations, or, you know, and more as a narrative like I do, way back in the 1950s. And his daughter has republished, and she briefly had a couple of series of the Holzer Files, if people have heard of the Holzer Files. Hans Holzer made a practice, and I patterned some of what I do on him because it made sense. He does a historic background check, where he did, and then he would do a visitation with the owners, and then at a certain point, he would bring a consulting psychic with him. He used a woman named Sybil Leek quite a bit, and then would just walk around and listen and record her impressions. So in this case, the apartments were going to go, and I didn't feel secure in like going and setting up a paranormal investigating equipment long-term in any of these rooms. So we did a walkthrough and we talked to tenants, and my friend Karen, who's should be on the back of that book with me. Yep, that is my friend Karen. We're kind of mugging for the camera there. Karen did a walkthrough, and she knew nothing about the history of the apartments. She went in cold with me, and I, of course, had already talked to the owners or to the manager. So really, some of this is not a case where somebody could say, well, you talked to the manager and you prompted Karen. No, some of what came out of the history of these incidents in the building, actually, I was talking to the manager in her office when Karen went off with the assistant manager on her walk around. And so, so this is not a case where I already knew in advance. So Karen went through on a walk around. I was writing notes with the manager, and she came back. Karen came back with the assistant manager, who recorded which room numbers Karen stopped opposite. And she had a healthy percentage of hits. That is, where the manager told me incidents were happening, Karen also several times came up with, well, I got this weird sensation here, or I got this weird sensation there, and they coincided. And for people doing paranormal investigating who really do it a lot, you don't get hits 100% of the time. I am always suspicious when somebody says every single place I visited, every single time I got something paranormal. That's just outside the boundaries of the law of averages. And so she got a healthy number of yeses, as well as details that coincided with what the manager told me. So we could not have coordinated. She was not wearing an earpiece. And so that's what makes the Civic Apartments particularly interesting as far as people looking for confirmation or evidence. And the other thing is, if you have a house where somebody, one family, has been living in the same house for decades, 30 years in this house, and so you can make a guess as to if it's haunted, who the ghost is. In apartments, these were at a certain point became low income housing. If you have an apartment complex, somebody may be there in one apartment 1 month, somebody may be there 8 years. So you have this layering and layering and layering. And so people in, people out, people who are there short term, generally there's some kind of disturbance in their life that embeds itself in. And also, unfortunately, part of the problem the manager cited was drug use, drug abuse by some of the tenants, not all of them, but even one person doing drugs has this effect where they disrupt everybody around them. And so Karen ended up picking up on a lot of this. Very much, it is one of these things where I get to sit back and watch my consulting psychic give the reading, and then having the source person, the occupant or owner go, followed by, oh my God.
Yeah.
And so that happens. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you touched on this in your book too, as well as people who, you know, had passed on possibly in a place like an apartment building where it was already, you know, there's going to be a lot of those layers, like people are passed and gone. There's the energy that is left by currently living people too. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying with the drug use, that person could very well still be living right now. And just having done that and that energy, like, imprinted itself, or that's what's there too. So it's just, it's you, like when you're saying layering, it's like layers upon layers upon layers across the years.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, consider this apartment complex again, even from its beginning, it was blue collar. And then, mm-hmm. and then as the decades go by, things get shabbier. And so do the clientele. And, yeah. and this is my economic base. I'm not talking about looking down on people. This is more along the lines of, the apartment gets older, the neighbor gets older, and people find harder times to make the rent. And so if you're living in fear of being evicted, that is not a good thing. You radiate that, mm-hmm. these economic times now with $2,000-$2,500 for a one bedroom apartment in some places, and people are making minimum wage. That's just got to be settling in the walls and the floor, and that desperation, just like if you go to a church, a place where people have been worshiping for centuries, decades, centuries, you know, it may even, you just walk in and you just get this feeling, it's like all hushed. Mm-hmm. And in some cases the church has been converted to other uses, but it still seems to have that aura to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in all of the investigations and walkthroughs and research that you've done for all these locations, have you found over the years that there are just specific types of locations that are kind of always going to beat the odds as far as being haunted or affected?
Yes. Churches are one. And yeah, hotels and places where people are transitory. Let's face it, again, one family living in one house for 30 years, eventually the owner's probably going to die at the house, because that's the law of averages too. But that's kind of it. You go to a hotel, or an apartment complex with 30, 40 units, you can count on at least one person dying a year in their apartment. And right. So if you do believe, and this gets to the law of averages, if you do believe that somebody has to die in a place in order for it to become haunted, you're geometrically increasing the percentages of that place being haunted. Right. And people too, as transitory residents, you get it, how they people treat the place they're living in is different than if you own it. If you're renting a place, you take less care of things, and I don't know. It's just, there's a lot more contentment owning a house than renting it. And same thing, if a hotel where you're staying there one or two days, people are more inclined to be a little lackadaisical in their actions when they can drive away afterward. Now I'm making it sound like every person who travels is a criminal. I'm sorry.
No, I got it. I think we get it. Well, Jeff, have you had your own personal experiences, not on a case, not anything like that, but like something that just specifically happened to you?
Yes, absolutely. And this is very personal, because this relates to the death of my father. And even though I've said this is personal, it is. But for people who have taken care of the elderly, of geriatric patients, family members in particular, at a certain point in that caregiving, tragic things happen. Absolutely, because the end result is this person dies. But you reach a point where you either cry and break down and collapse and become ineffective, or or you got to laugh, because it to me there was said of this, my taking here from my father is like, okay, I can either fall apart, or I can just kind of these things are so absurd. The death of my father, I chose to laugh about it. Some aspects of I didn't laugh at my father dying, but the circumstances surrounding it were so, you don't even get in a movie. It was so absurd. This was a couple of years ago at the beginning of COVID lockdown. My father did not die of COVID. He had a lot of cardiac problems, as well as he had dementia that was very quickly advancing. And when I say it was his time, it really was his time. And so I was trying to go through things to try and figure out how am I going to pay for dad's healthcare, because he needed 24-hour care. And I had already tried, and I just could not myself alone be with him and take care of him adequately 24 hours a day. So I put him in an adult group home, and I got a phone call from the owner of the facility. And she said, "Mr. Davis." I said, "Yes." She said, "I've got to tell you, your father's not breathing." I said, "What? He is not breathing." And I said, is his heart beating?" And she said, "No." And I said, "Then he's dead." And she said, "No, I can't pronounce him dead. I'm not a doctor." Yeah. Okay. Here's where the absurdity begins. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I'll be right over. And so I drove over there, and sure enough, he was dead. But the absurdity continued. At first, the owner wanted to talk about paperwork and did I already have a funeral service coming to pick up his body, and so on and so forth. And I had to say, let's hold on a minute. Let me go see my father. Okay. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. And she said, "Yes, you see, he's not breathing, his heart's not beating, but I can't pronounce him dead." So I said, "He's not quite dead yet. Anyone who's seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, you know, with bring out your dead,
I'm not dead yet.
You'll be stone dead in a minute. Just shut up. Do us a favor." And so that became the pattern of this day. The local coroners were on lockdown. So I called 911 and they sent out the paramedics, and they said, "Oh, he's dead." I said, "Yeah." They said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm the son." They said, "We thought you were just an employee. That's why we ignored you." "No, I'm a son." So, you know, can you call the coroners? "Oh, they aren't coming out." And I said, "Well, I was told you," because I called 911 and the owner was right next to me saying, you cannot say he's dead. You can just say that his heart's not beating and he's not breathing, because you're not a doctor either." And so the paramedic said, "Well, we're not doctors. We can't pronounce him dead."
Oh.
And then they called and they got a senior paramedic, and he said the same thing. So I said, he's not quite dead yet. He's biologically dead, but legally he's not dead. And they like, "Oh yeah, yeah." And then they called a police officer, and he talked to the coroners back and mm-hmm. forth. And I said, "Well, can you pronounce my father dead?" "Oh no, I can't either." And so, long story short, this took hours and hours. And then the funeral home, by this time it's like rush hour. The funeral home sent out the pickup vehicle. I refused to call it a meat wagon, and he got stuck in traffic on the freeway before he arrived. And so eventually, 2 or 3 weeks later, I did get a death certificate signed by the funeral home. So I was exhausted by this time. And part of this too, in addition to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, it also reminded me of the Wizard of Oz. You know, the house gets picked up by the tornado and lands on mm-hmm. the witch. So Dorothy is in talking and singing with all the munchkins. And one of them walks up and sings, "As coroner, I certify that she is not just completely dead. She is most sincerely dead. And he holds up a death certificate. So this whole thing was running through my mind. And again, I had to treat it with a sense of humor. Otherwise, I would have just fallen apart. Yeah. And I picked up some of his stuff and I came back to my house. And I put his stuff. My dad had lived with me for a while in the back room of the house. And so I put his stuff down in that back room. And I can even point. And then this back room is here. Back room is, let me see, there. And instead, I went and sat down on the couch. And I had fostered his cat, and I had my own. Lucifer, I'm not a devil worshiper. He was black. And Ping, my dad's cat. And the two of them did not get along. And I was sitting on the couch for 15 or 20 minutes, just breathing. And then I noticed, to me, the oddest thing. Ping and Lucifer walked over toward the entrance to the family room, which led to the back bedrooms. And they sat shoulder to shoulder looking at the back of the house. And they did not get along. Ping used to hiss at him if he came within 3 feet of her. But there they were, just sitting, staring at the back of the house. And then finally, Ping stood up, and she hesitated. She was on three paws, and one of her front paws was kind of like half cocked in the air, as you know how cats, if they're thinking about, do I want to go forward or not? Mm-hmm. And then she slowly, stiff-leggedly walked to the back of the house, and I lost sight of her. But a few seconds later, she came running from the back of the house, past Lucifer. And she hit the linoleum on the kitchen and slid and almost slid into the fridge. And then she picked herself up and came back, and she sat right next to Lucifer. And then he stood up and did the same. And that happened 3 times. And then they were sitting next to each other. Ping looked at Lucifer and hissed at him and walked away. It's like the spell was broken. So if you're looking at things like a plausible explanation, I have a couple. It has been documented in the last couple of years at nursing homes, as well as hospice centers, where there are cats that seem to know somebody's going to die. They will jump up on the bed with the person and stay with them until they die, or they will jump off again, and within hours they're dead. So yeah. It says to me, cats can smell it, if nothing else. Even if you don't believe in psyche, cats will smell it. So I had brought dad's stuff with me and put a little bit of stuff in the back. Plus, that had been his room, and I had been around him too. So did they alert on that smell? Or did dad come home with me? And dad loved cats too. And was he actually calling them to the back of the house as kind of a message to me that he was okay? And then he was able to move on, and then the cats went back to normal. And other watchers can probably think of other plausible explanations.
Yeah. I mean, I know I've got my own personal stories too, that, you know, other people can think, you know, whatever they want to come up with, you know, their own possible solutions. But you know, when you're in it, when you're experiencing it yourself, like, I don't know, it's hard to explain sometimes. Like you get that feeling, you think, well, I think this is what that is. But yeah, wow. That's a story that's in your new book, right? Is that what you were saying before we started recording?
Yes. This is the bad thing. When you work on 3 books, you can only nudge a little bit in each book. My current book project I'm working on is Vancouver, USA, because there's a Vancouver, Washington volume 2. Because I live in Vancouver and my father died here, I'm including that story in that book. And so I hope to have it out in time for Christmas.
Oh gosh, you'll have to let me know. I will shout it out and put it up everywhere. That's awesome. And
Thank you.
Looking for you to recommend another book too. So we'll be sure to let people know when that's available.
Okay, great.
Oh gosh, well, thank you so much for that. Thank you. That was a really cool story.
Well, and it's a catharsis to talk about it too.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's such a, even now there's such a stigma to talking about relatives passing on. And the older we get, mathematically, the greater number of dead people we will have known until it's us. And so why not talk about it? Because it's a horrible thing is why, I guess.
I don't really get it either. Yeah. But, you know, it is cathartic to talk about, and we should all be more, little bit more comfortable talking about it too. I'll bring up my brother-in-law on the show every now and then, because he passed away about a year ago. So I'll bring up weird things that happen, and it's nice to be able to tell people.
Hey, this is BJ.
And this is Mitra.
And we're from the Unrefined Podcast.
Do you like ghost stories, urban legends, spooky tales that will chill your spine?
Whoa.
What? I'm just getting into it, okay?
Just a little bit. But seriously, if you want to hear us talk about all things that are unexplained,
but with a good sense of humor,
then tune into Unrefined, your favorite paranormal podcast.
New episodes out every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And make sure to subscribe to get the latest episodes of Unrefined right to your device.
So, your father, he was in the military. Vancouver Barracks. Yeah. Okay. So for my listeners, Jeff also, he hosts ghost tours, ghost walks. And as I understand it, you are still doing a ghost walk tour at the Vancouver Barracks.
Yes.
Okay. How often, like give us the details of all of that and like kind of what you cover on that walk.
Sure. My father was stationed at the Vancouver Barracks, and when I was 17 years old, I enlisted in the Army Reserves there. And 30 some years later, the Army left the barracks, and I was the last soldier, to the best of my knowledge, who had an office. I actually worked there until we vacated, and that was in that was 2011. And one of my assignments was as a military historian. So it just naturally fell in. If your viewers know kind of the approach to ghost stories, is history. And ghost stories are a great way, ghost walks, to teach history without boring people. And so this is in Vancouver, Washington, opposite Portland, Oregon. This is not the Vancouver in Canada. And the Army was there from 1849 to 2011. And many buildings still from the early days exist. The oldest being called the Ulysses S. Grant House, even though Grant never lived there. It was the first large building dating to 1849. And so my ghost walks, I actually start in the parking lot opposite the Grant House. And recently we've had private parties do a dinner at the Grant House, and there are as many as five ghosts at the Grant House itself. I talk ghosts to the dinner party and or do a walk around. And the normal season is June through Halloween. June, July, and August, I pick one weekend a month to do the walk. And then September and October, almost every weekend. Now, I do private parties year-round. And so if somebody does want, you have a group of friends or your paranormal investigating team, and you want to bring some gizmos with you along the walk, we can do that. We don't get to go into any buildings because different agencies now own the barracks, and most of the buildings are rented out. But we go on porches, and let's face it, it's much nicer doing walking around the outside of the buildings with a handful of people and a guide, just in case the police stop by and ask you, what are you doing here? And so and I think I've kind of covered everything. The walk is about a mile and a quarter, and again we go on porches and we walk around, and I do talk about the history of the barracks, which it's kind of funny. After World War II, they gave away most of the land, and so it used to be a half mile wide and 2 miles long, like one square mile in the middle of what's now Vancouver, Washington. and it's been largely forgotten even by local residents. So it is a great place as part of my heritage, and I like sharing it with people, ghosts or no ghosts. And we do have stuff actually happen even outside, because some of the ghosts are outside ghosts. The Army parade ground is haunted, and sadly enough, there were several suicides by hanging in the outside of some of these buildings, and there is a post hospital that was built in 1904 and was in use till about 1941, and you know, medicine in the 1900s, one of the things that happened there, this was about 2 years ago, was I was leading a tour and I was talking about the instance where you have a group of people and a paranormal event happens and only one or two people perceive it in a group of 20, and they're left looking at each other and not saying anything because nobody's reacting. I'm sure you've seen that happen too.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And so we finished the tour. We went all the way back to the parking lot. And I was standing outside my car, kind of waving at people. It was nighttime. And the last car actually delayed. What I thought was the last car drove off. And 2 or 3 minutes later, another car. It's like I was transported into a horror movie. Lights come on at the far end of the parking lot. And this car slowly travels to me. And then it stopped opposite me, and the window started going, and I said, somebody's going to shoot me in the face, aren't they? It turned out to be one of the people on the tour. And he said, sorry for scaring you, Jeff, because he did. but we waited because I had a question to ask you, but I didn't want to say it in front of the group. When you were up there talking on the porch about things happening to other people, when you talked about that, did you hear the drumming? And I said, what? He said, the drumming. Sounded like somebody was drumming, brum, brum, beating a tattoo on a drum. And as you were talking about this, I heard the sound. And the entire time we were standing in front of that building until we walked down. And as soon as we got out of sight of the building, it stopped. So I was wondering if you heard that. And I said, no. And nobody else ever reported that. He said, you know, this is one of these instances where it manifested specifically to only one person on the tour.
Right. What does that make you theorize about, like, different people's abilities to sense that stuff over others?
Well, in this case, it may well have been that there was an active spirit that wanted to contact anyone to validate this. And he just happened to be in the right frame of mind. And I'm not psychic. I make no claim to have the sight. It contacted the right person, I guess, because he also was brave enough to actually come up afterward and talk about it. A lot of people, as you probably found, have this stuff happen and they hold it in and they never talk about it because they're afraid of ridicule. And this was, strangely enough, this is one of the reasons why I have been able to be a guest on any number of television shows having to do with history and the paranormal. Is a lot of people in the history archaeology business, they're considered fringe anyway, like politically fringe by a lot of people, or you know, absent-minded professor types. And so to talk about the paranormal is a little difficult for them if they're doing it on camera. And so I don't have that. I guess I don't have that kind of a filter, it's not there all that often. So I am okay talking about history on a show that's investigating the paranormal. I had an anthropology professor who has since passed on, and he worked extensively with the Tarahumara Indians along the Mexican-American border into the South. And he described some experiences he had. A little bit to the class once. He just got in the mood and went ahead and shared it, but not very often. And I asked him, I said, so does this kind of stuff, what ended up happening to him was he offended the local shaman to the point where he would wake up in the middle of the night and look out his window, and there was a man standing outside his window with glowing red eyes looking in on him, gesturing with various fetish kind of devices. And when he went out to investigate, there were no footprints in the soft dirt.
Oh.
And yeah. And so he actually had to make a formal apology and do some other kinds of rituals himself to satisfy the feud. And as I said, did other people have these kind of things? He said, yeah, all the time, but we don't write about it because people will think we're crazy.
Yeah. Well, oh my gosh. You know, you're the way you tell stories, just like it just pulls you right in, and your grasp on the details and the just the historical facts. I would love to make it to one of these walks at some point when I'm back over on the west side. One other thing that you do, and then we're gonna get to our final section here, but you also run something called the Paranormal Pub, and I need you to tell my audience about it, because it is so freaking cool. It's like my jam. If I were in Portland, I would be there every month.
Well, here's the nice thing about this, folks: there is no franchise fee. Right. This is not a money maker for me or anybody. As a matter of fact, it's a time taker. Anybody who's ever been to a paranormal conference or multi-day event, yes, there are classes or there are the vendor tables. You can get your palm read. You can, you know, cast the bones, all this kind of stuff, or you can go do these things on becoming a psychic yourself. All interesting stuff. But usually the best time I have is in the hallway outside, coming on someone randomly, a friend or a stranger, and talking and just having this exchange of ideas. I always found that more interesting. And so some years ago, I was talking to some other paranormal folks, and if you're living on the west side, you've heard of the McMenamins Brothers Hotel and brewery winery chains. They buy distressed old properties and turn them into hotels, mostly haunted. And so they themselves had one Sunday a month, they had their own paranormal pub at one of the theaters. And so they had speakers, and you buy beer and pizza kind of stuff, and all good stuff. I enjoy that. But living on Vancouver, where the Columbia River is becoming a barrier to travel now again, I said, you know what? I'd like to have that kind of an effect too, where I don't have to drive to Portland. And so I looked around, and I found a bar that would let me host what I just called the Vancouver Informal Paranormal Pub. And it was like, hey, anybody who wants to drive and hang out for an hour or two and maybe have presentations if somebody wants to talk about stuff, let's do it. And we ended up having to move, as you might expect. We didn't have any money to rent the room, right? So it took us a couple of places before we fetched up at a place in Vancouver called the Underbar, which is Vancouver's only underground pub. And it was originally it was the Underbar because they wanted to have this speakeasy theme to it, and is since changed. So now, and I talked to the owners, you know, how would you describe the place? A sparkly rainbow prohibition themed place, and they have a lot of events, and they host my pub. And again, there's no cover. And there's a request that people actually show up and buy something off the menu. And it's good food, good drinks. And so we show up at about, I show up about 2:30, set up the computer about 3 o'clock, people drift in and we visit and we talk and we chit chat. At 4 o'clock, that's when we have a presentation. Sometimes it's me. I co-host with a guy named Rocky Smith, who is the president of the Oregon Ghost Conference. So he also brings in guests to talk. And so we have a presentation to 5, and then people generally will hang out for another 45 minutes to an hour. And it's just to have fun. This is exchange of ideas, trying to be respectful to people, even if you happen to be a hardwired ghost hunter with $3,000 worth of gizmos. Be respectful of somebody who's a clairvoyant who just goes in and gets the read, and vice versa. And so we just picked, here's the thing. I encourage anybody, find a bar, find a club, find a pub, to do this kind of stuff just for the fun of it. If you're expecting to super boost your career, it's not going to work. If you're expecting to make money out of it, no, it's not going to work. But if you want to stay connected to your local community, this is a great thing to do. And again, it's tolerance and patience, and meeting people you not normally meet, even in the paranormal realm, who just want to hang out. So yeah. I make this as a pitch because I hope it comes across. I'm passionate about this because it's a lot of fun. And every now and then, there are some horror movies or shows that, you know, you pay your dollar and you can do a watch party. Everybody pays a dollar to whatever streaming service. That's not very much money. And you watch a show. In some cases, people in your community may have been on the show, or people in your community have their own really popular podcast. Mm-hmm. And this a great place for you to get sources. Is funny. I don't know if you've heard of Clyde Lewis or not. Ground Zero Radio. He's based out of Portland, and his show is radio as well as podcasting. And he just said, hey, this sounds like fun. I'd like to be on the show too. And so a whole bunch of his fans showed up, and they're all lining up to shake Clyde's hand. It was great.
Well, I was, you know, what I was saying before in the email, like, I'm serious. I would love to have something like this in this area, because you know what, like you were saying, it's a good way to just meet, you know, your fellow just kindred spirits, like see who else is out there in the community and just be of that, you know, get in that energy and that mind. Meet, get sources too, you know?
Yeah. Because let's face it, for a lot of people who are into paranormal investigating, it is a spiritual quest. Mm-hmm. It is very, very personal. And some people forget that it's a spiritual quest for the next guy or gal or other person. Mm-hmm. And so we can all visit the same haunted location at different times and do our own investigating without altercations. Mm-hmm. And so in a social setting like this, you get to actually meet people not as competitors, but maybe as consultants.
Right. Absolutely.
And,
Well, I was going to ask where can folks, like, if there are any locals who are hearing this and they're very interested in joining in the fun, or anybody wants to travel over there, is there somewhere online that they can actually see your guys' schedule for, like, I know you do it once a month, right? But like the actual schedule?
Yes. Yes. Here's the thing. If you organize your own, Kristen, you cannot pick any weekend, either Saturday or Sunday, you know, like recurring second Sunday of the month, without impinging on some holiday.
Sure.
First, second, third. So we lost out. We competed a little bit recently with the Super Bowl, but that's okay. And Mother's Day, I think. We're the second Sunday of each month. So there's a Facebook page for it, and it's listed as private. And I can't unprivate it now because Facebook won't let me. But look up Vancouver Informal Paranormal Pub on Facebook, or look for The Underbar in Vancouver, and they list it typically on their schedule the week before. But it's recurring second Sunday of each month. This next Sunday, Rocky Smith will talk about ghosts of Seaside, Oregon, which is where we're having the ghost conference, and highlight some of the speakers that we're having. May, I will be probably talking about haunted England. I am getting ready to go there, and I'm going to be staying in a renting short term, one of the few residences at Hampton Court Palace that's open to the public as kind of a B&B. And I will be in Shrewsbury. If anybody's a Shakespeare, Henry IV, Part One fan, Harry Hotspur, I will be staying in, the remaining medieval tower from the old city walls, which is now a luxury stay in a 13th century tower.
Whoa.
Can't beat that. Yeah.
No, that is very cool.
And so I'll be talking about that. That's the other nice thing. If you want to meet up with folks and do like a group investigation, and for instance, the Cape Disappointment Lighthouse Keepers Cottages, on the Washington coast. There are two cottages, which are subdivided into three residences. If you pool your money, you can stay there individually very cheaply by just pooling the money. So that's okay. That's another good thing about the pub, in meeting other people.
Yeah. Learn all the little secret hotspots and stuff.
Yeah.
And places to stay.
Maybe Pullman has some pubs that would let you host.
I'm thinking probably more so Moscow. They got the cool places, but yeah. I'm gonna put the feelers out.
Yeah, I used to order furs from Moscow Hide and Fur.
Oh.
I used to do my own tanning.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that was
the archaeologist in me. Yeah, there's a company called Moscow Hide and Fur, and they're in Moscow, Idaho, and they will sell fur, bone, skulls, all kinds of critter stuff there. Okay. I'm giving them a plug without asking your permission. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. Plug away. Because, you know, I didn't know. So let's teach the people. Well, Jeff, so we are running up against time. There was specifically something I wanted to ask you about Bigfoot, but I'm thinking if you would prefer, just so that we don't, you know, hit our time limit, we can save that for a little Patreon backstage chat. Does that sound good? So yeah, listeners, if you're interested, you can join the Patreon. Jeff and I today will be speaking about some of the history that he learned, the prehistory he learned about the Nantinak and Port Chatham. And he was the featured historian on Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, which was an awesome show. I so enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
It still may be.
Yeah. Okay.
I can talk a little bit about that for people on Patreon.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's have our Bigfoot discussion on Patreon in just a moment. With that, let's do our final questions, final thoughts, and then we'll send folks somewhere online to learn more about you and get your books. So first question specifically for you, these just come based on some, you know, specific research that I had on you and your book. What is your opinion on photo captures of orbs?
You know what? I'm happy to see that the number of people walking around with digital cameras saying, oh my God, this is a spirit orb, have dramatically decreased from when digital cameras became inexpensive. I'm sure you remember how it's like everything, all the TV shows, all the websites, oh my God, this is a ghost. We got these orb photos. And most of them is dust. It's dust or dirt or light effects. I think you've got the book where I talk about orb photos in the chapter, Some Thoughts on Ghost Hunting. I won't go into in detail. It was design flaws. It was physical design of the cameras was flawed, and it created focus distortions that the cheap computer chips they were using misinterpreted as circles, as translucent circles. Having said that, now where we have these really expensive cameras that are just as good as an analog camera, as a film camera, you notice there have not been that many people showing up with orb photos. And I will tend now to look at somebody's orb photo a little bit less critically, a little bit more, let's look at this for sure. Yeah. So I am curious about orb photos. I have had some myself, mostly with film cameras. So I trust my film camera a little bit more than I would have trusted my digital in the 2000s. So not really all that impressed with orb photos or white noise. By white noise, like on television, where you look at the television, you see the shapes and all that. Not all impressed by that, because I grew up in a house with bad television reception, and so we had like the wire and the paper clips 10 feet long as an antenna, and we were always getting ghost images from other TV stations.
So I'm
a little bit more critical of that. If you notice, and this is good, where you have a phenomena appear and everybody jumps on the boat, but over time you have people actually testing it more with the scientific method critically and saying, no, here is what we think it is. And then they can demonstrate it. That's actually science. And so we do, we have orb photos, we have these white noise videos and white noise AM radio, and in various ways, I won't say debunked, but it's been shown that the phenomena has a natural cause. And so I'm actually okay with this stuff showing up as long as people look at it critically.
Absolutely. Agreed. All right. Second question for you. I do have a lot of paranormal investigators that tune into the show. Which piece of equipment is the most overrated and which is the most underutilized?
You're going to get me sued now. Everybody has, you know, here's the thing. And I've said this numerous times to various people. All of these ghost hunter gizmos, all of them are scientific devices designed for something else other than ghost hunting. They have been modified and or changed out, but they had other uses. For instance, electromagnetic field meter. You know what? That's originally a Gauss meter. It measures various kinds of electromagnetic radiation, not ghosts. And so people are using it for this application. So the simpler the device, the more I trust it. Again, knowing what its uses are. So my electromagnetic radiation detector, I always take, and it's a Gauss meter, and it's analog. So it's got the needle. It's got a physical needle. I like that. I don't like the ones with the blinky lights. You know, you're going from green to yellow to red. Right. What does that mean? Other than it looks really cool. So I like and trust that. Here's the other thing is multiple, if you're going to do something, one or two devices, one device having an anomalous response to stimulus, i.e. one thing reacting, is not as important as I've got my Gauss meter out and the needle starts flickering at the same time as I have my audio recorder out and I'm doing electronic voice phenomena. Yeah. So if the two of them, if I get anomalies in voice at the same time as the needle is flicking back and forth, that I trust a lot more. The simpler the device, the better. I have friends who have the, sit for an hour trying to answer questions in depth and see if you don't forget names. Okay. So what's the thing with the sticks in the chairs? I'm sorry.
Like the sticks in the chairs?
You have
the dowsing rods or?
No. You turn the video on a chair and then ask the ghost to sit in the chair and then it superimposes and you get a human-like figure.
Oh, the I know what you're talking about. No, sit and ask in-depth questions for an hour and see if you forget. I know what you're
everybody is shouting. Everybody is shouting. And my apologies. The interesting thing about these, as I understand it, these are some kind of Game Boy Xbox controllers. That's how they started their existence. And if I'm wrong, I know you'll hear about it. But when you have, you remember the Wii and all these other things where it sits on the TV, on top of the TV, and you're watching the TV and this device is sitting on the top of it. It's looking at you so that you, when you fish or play tennis, you've got a camera watching you and it's analyzing your movements. And then through software is putting it on the screen. That's how you can tell if you're fishing. I use that as the analogy. You're fishing, you know, you're hitting the right spot in the pond is because you have a computer analyzing your movements. So it is my understanding, and I could be wrong, that people are taking the guts of this. They're taking the camera and the controller, and they're playing a little bit with software where it is now looking at something like a chair or a wall, and it's following its software imperative, which is to look for a human-like figure. So just like the ghost orbs, where you've got something out of focus in the flash and the computer and the chips and the software are looking for a pattern because that's what they do. They're getting the orb because you've got something out of focus. So that may be an explanation for how and why a you set out a chair with arms on it, it kind of, it's designed to hold a human being with arms. And so the computer controller, after a few seconds, may well put the figure in there. Now, I stop there and say that may well be a practical explanation for how you get those figures, like it starting in a chair. Having said that, when you have people saying, get up and move, move to your left, move to your right, raise your left arm, raise your right arm, I don't know how the computer in the controller could do that. But that's something that people have recorded.
Yeah.
They've gotten responses. Yeah. So this is something that should still be investigated and experimented with.
Mm-hmm.
I find it all cool. I don't have the whatever $1,300 to buy one of these experiment myself, though.
They sure are expensive, all of this equipment now. And it's just so funny to me because, like you were saying, a lot of this stuff is just based on, you know, stuff that was meant for something else. And, you know, like the, what was it, the K2 meter? It used to be like 10 bucks, you know, back in the day. And now they're selling them for like 70 or more. I find it interesting too. But
yeah. And, you know, some people, and God bless everybody for trying to earn a little bit of money, because that's, we should support ourselves, you know, where you have people who buy 10 of those things from a manufacturer, and then they put them on their website, they put their own sticker on it. And so it's been now branded by this paranormal group.
Yeah.
So the things that I find really useful is low tech. It is my Gauss meter with the analog dial, I guess like $150 now, and a simple digital audio recorder with a portable speaker, like a tour guide speaker. So you can immediately listen to your EVP responses. Those are great go-tos. They're not very expensive. Because they're not complicated, it's harder for something to go wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I have just the one more question in this final segment. Let's keep it brief. And I just want to give you the opportunity to give us a little chuckle here at the end. IMDb made me do it. Sorry. What is a firewalk and why do you do them?
When I was writing the book Weird Washington for Barnes & Noble, which is a book of odd and unusual in each state, a firewalk, at the time, the world's hottest firewalk took place in Vancouver, Washington. So I wrote about it, but the person who did it, I couldn't contact. So the publisher said, Jeff, would you do a firewalk for us and take pictures? And you know what? We're not going to pay you for that chapter until we have photos. And then I can't remember the exact details. And I said, well, how about if we send you a digital video recorder, you record the video on video for us and we'll let you keep the recorder. And I have no pride and I'm cheap. And in 2007, digital video recorders were really expensive. So I did that. And every now and then somebody will ask me to do one. And I approach it the same way. There are various physicists who will tell you why you'll never get burned doing it, and don't be afraid, to other people saying, oh, yes, you will get burned, but, you know, spiritual enlightenment and people everywhere in between. And so if you do one, do not say Jeff Davis told you to do one, because it is dangerous. So this is not me advocating, and don't sue me, because people do get burned. I've been burned. Mm-hmm. But doing a firewalk, you're not the same afterward, whether it's spiritual or psychological, whatever. Everybody who does one comes out a little bit different afterward. Mm-hmm. But I'm not telling you to do one.
You're IMDb.
Kristen isn't either.
Not advocating. Don't get burned. But
I do have a video. Yeah, I do have a video up on IMDb.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So check it out, folks. You know, experience through watching Jeff.
Yeah.
All right, sir. Where can folks find more about what you do, what you're about online, and where can they buy your books?
Well, I have two websites. I have a WordPress site, which is very much abbreviated. It's Jeff Davis Ghost Guy. My original website is all spelled out one word, ghostsandcritters.com. For the rest of this year, if you go to ghostsandcritters.com, there will be a redirect button that'll take you to Ghost Guy, or you click on the icon, you can stay on my old website. And I've got over 20 years of archive. You know, every year I would start a new year of happenings. You can buy my books on either site. And so if you're interested in my books, if you're interested in 20 some years of plunking around the Pacific Northwest for ghosts, that's there too.
Wonderful. And to close out the episode, would you like to leave my audience with any final thoughts, words of wisdom, or a piece of advice?
As things are progressing right now, we're living, I'm starting to get really sensitive. Let me go like this. We're living in times when everything seems adversarial. And in looking into the paranormal, it is very personal. It's very spiritual. It's very important to all of us. Please be respectful to everybody else you encounter, even if they have a different approach, because it is so personal. Even if you don't agree, just be respectful, get out of their way, and hopefully everybody else will treat you the same way, just with respect. I don't ghost hunt in cemeteries, particularly at night, because they're not safe because of crime. So just remember, you're looking for the paranormal realm in our world. Our world is still there with all of its dangers and all of its cautions. Obey the law, don't trespass, and so on. So that is my advice. Just enter into this with your eyes open, and remember, there are laws and other people out there too.
Author, historian, ghost guy, Jefferson Davis, thank you so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure, Kristen. I hope everybody else enjoyed it. And please be gentle with the actual name of the gizmo we can't remember.
No shouting out there, folks. All right, Jeff, thanks.
My pleasure.
Thank you all so much for tuning in. After watching Jeff's appearance and work on Alaskan Killer Bigfoot, I had to ask him about what he learned during the production. Mr. Davis was gracious enough to join me backstage to share his information about Portlock and its grisly history and its infamous hairy resident. Follow the Patreon link in the show notes to learn how you can support the show and get your ears on this awesome extra. Once there, you will also enjoy a clip from today's episode of my favorite blooper by far in the history of this show. The show literally came to a standstill. I still laugh when I listen to it. Catch it over on Patreon. You're going to love it. Learn more about Jeff Davis, his ghost walks, Vancouver's informal paranormal pub, and grab copies of all of his books at the links below. That will be a wrap on today's episode. You lads and lasses, have a great St. Patrick's Day. Be good now. You hear? Well, mostly good. And I shall see you back here on Tuesday. Slán tamil, everyone. Stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.